Hello, hello, and welcome to Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make art house, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. Welcome to a very special episode of Art House Garage. My friend Michael Daugherty is here today for a discussion about disability and the movies. Michael is a filmmaker and a disability advocate, and I invited him to come and talk about this subject after I watched a recent film that made me want to reach out. That film is The Innocents, and we'll talk about that film and its depiction of disability, but we'll also have a more far-reaching discussion, including other films and general thoughts on this subject. Stick around. Before we get into it all, a quick plug for our Patreon. The Patreon gets you ad-free episodes, bonus episodes, extended episodes, and videos. I've started recording video whenever I have a guest on the show, and you can watch all of those over at Patreon. Besides that, your financial support of the show would mean the world. You can sign up at patreon.com/arthousegarage or find a link in the show notes.
Er du ny her?
Ja.
Skal jeg vise deg noe?
Ok.
Hvem er du snakker med?
Jeg snakker med noen som ikke er her.
Hold den opp. Hva er reglene dere jobber når dere er ute så lenge?
Hva det grise her?
Jeg kan få folk til å gjøre ting.
That was the trailer for the new film The Innocents, which I reviewed recently at arthousegarage.com. The Innocents is a horror/thriller from writer-director Eskil Vogt. Vogt also co-wrote the recent Oscar-nominated film The Worst Person in the World. The Innocents features four children as the main characters, and they begin to develop supernatural powers. The film looks at our human capacities for cruelty and empathy by looking at these children and how they behave under pressure. The film is moody and atmospheric, and things get pretty dark. While I admire the filmmaking of The Innocents and find its setting, performances, and tension building quite effective, there's one aspect of the film that I took issue with. The main character, Ida, has a sister named Anna, and Anna has an intellectual disability. The depiction of the character made me pause, and some aspects of the story ended up really rubbing me the wrong way. To be clear, I believe the filmmakers acted in good faith when creating this story. Their intentions seemed to be respectful, and they even probably thought this was empowering. But the way the story plays out, I feel, has some major issues. I'll talk about those issues in more detail in just a moment. I wrote all about this in my review, but I felt like I wanted to talk more about it for myself and for my listeners. So I gave my friend Michael Daugherty a call. He's a filmmaker and disability advocate, as I mentioned, and he was game to come on the show and hash it out a bit more. Before we talk to Michael, I'm going to play a brief interview clip. As I mentioned, this film was written and directed by Eskil Vogt, and I actually had the opportunity to speak with him recently over Zoom. We only spoke for about 5 minutes, but I did ask him about the Anna character. You can watch my whole interview on YouTube. I'll link that in the show notes. But here is the clip where he talked about this character, Anna, who has autism and is nonverbal. I am here with Eskil Vogt, the Oscar-nominated screenwriter behind The Worst Person in the World and the writer and director of the new film, The Innocents. Thank you so much for talking with me today. Mm-hmm. I think the most interesting character in the film is Anna, who has autism and is nonverbal, or at least has limited verbal communication. I'm curious what inspired you to include a disabled character like Anna in the story, and what preparation went into bringing Anna to the screen?
Well, she came a little bit later in the process. I'd started to work on this secret world of childhood, the way it's closed off from the adult world. And I read an interview with a Norwegian author. She's called Olaug Nilsen, and she talked in a very open way about her own son, who had something she labeled regressive autism. That meant he was developing normally, communicating verbally until he was 3 or 4, and then he just lost gradually his language abilities and just retreated inside his bubble. And for me, as a father, for me that's a horror movie, you know, because of course if your kid is born with any disability, I would hope I would just accept that kid as he or she is. But if you feel that you're losing your child and that your child is trapped inside his body in some way, it's such a complicated grief, you know. So I was completely moved by that, and it just haunted me until the point where I was working on this and I said to myself, maybe this is part of the story, because what's more closed off and secret than a non-verbal child? It's like perfect for that kind of thematic. And also, I could, within this supernatural fable, kind of tell that story that moved me so much about the kid that communicates and then retreats. That could be part of my story. And it just blended perfectly. Then, of course, didn't want to hide behind the fact that it's a supernatural story to like make it easy for myself and just have complete liberties with something that's a very real dilemma for many parents and a real situation. So I did a lot of research, talked to parents. Of course, it's hard to get access because people are very protective of nonverbal autistic children because they don't know what. It's hard for them to say yes or no to stuff, you know, these kids. So, but we did get access to observing some of them and being in the same room and whatever. And of course, you have documentaries, you have talking to people, you have specialists, you have all that. I just wanted it to be done with respect and with enough detail so that those people who actually live it don't feel that we are taking too many liberties with something.
That was a clip from my interview with filmmaker Eskil Vogt, and I'm now joined by Michael Daugherty. Michael is a filmmaker, writer, and disability advocate, and he's the co-founder of the LA chapter of the Real Abilities Film Festival, and he's the writer and director of a PSA called Look Around. And then very recently, his screenplay, No One Is Looking, was included on the blacklist, on the disability sublist, sort of the top 10 unproduced scripts featuring disability in some way. So congratulations on that, and welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, boss. I'm honored and happy to be here. And let's see if we can go twice as long as we did the last time.
There you go. Yes, Michael was here previously for Breaking the Waves. We talked at length about that film, and Michael also shared his story and some very personal parts of that story. Very good podcast. Highly recommend checking that out, just to hear Michael's story, if nothing else. But yeah, I'm so glad to have you back, and so excited to hear your thoughts about The Innocence and some other things. So I do want to kind of make it grander than just talking about this one film, but I would like to hear your thoughts on this film, and I can kind of share a little bit more specifically some of my thoughts too. But so what did you think about The Innocence and maybe specifically about the character of Anna?
I liked it. I liked the movie very, very much. I do see problems with it, and I think you and I will have a bit of a meal taking some of those aspects apart. But the first thing you have to say is that it's the greatest audition tape to direct an X-Men movie, probably ever.
Oh yeah. I mean, I didn't even think of that.
It's so clear that how connected to the X-Men that this is, because the kids have magical powers, and because those magical powers in the case of the girls, the little girls in the movie, are connected to disability in some way. And that's one of the things that I've always loved about Marvel and the X-Men is that those were really the first representations of disability that I saw were in those comic books with a lot of those characters. But I don't want to get too sidetracked on that. I was really, really intrigued by the movie, and especially because you flagged it before I had seen it, saying, I really think we need to talk about this. And so the subject comes up about Anna, who is the older sister of Ida, who is ostensibly the hero of the story, if we can say that there is one. Anna is on the spectrum and is nonverbal to the extent where she basically only moans. And she is played by an actress who is not on the spectrum. Now, you wanted me on to talk about disability representation in film. So here's where I would say is like one of the first red flags of the whole thing, because the fight currently within disability culture, as far as entertainment and Hollywood is concerned, is that there's too much of able-bodied actors playing disabled characters. And able-bodied, by the way, is a phrase that I fucking hate, because it implies a binary relationship that I did not agree to or sign up for, which suggests someone is not broken and I am somehow broken. So that's never really sat well with me. But to the extent that actors are cast to play these characters, there's been a pronounced movement within pop culture to have that changed, so that disabled actors, and there are hundreds of them out there, get to play those parts as authentically as possible. But here's the controversial part. I'm not entirely against the idea of a so-called able-bodied actor playing someone with a disability, because I think the whole purpose of art is empathy. It has always been that. And so if an actor feels that they want to tie themselves in knots to get at that experience, I don't object to it whole cloth. However, that doesn't mean that the people who make these types of things should use that as an excuse to leave out performers with disabilities that could play this more authentically. So in the case of the actress whose name escapes me, who played Anna?
Yes, I can pull it up in just a moment. But yeah, it's a Norwegian film. I don't know if I mentioned that. So all the actors are from that part of the world. And I may also not pronounce this quite correctly, but it's Alva Brinsmo Ramstad.
So she is not on the spectrum. And there's a queasy bit to her performance because of the moaning in particular, that it almost feels like there's some sort of caricature going on.
Yeah.
Where I think that gets challenged is how essential she is to the mysticism or the superpowers or the supernatural aspect of the story, and how she gets drawn in with this other little girl, Aisha, who's played by an Indian actress, I believe, who has vitiligo. Which,
yes, and her name is Mina Yasmin Brimseth Isham.
Yes.
Sorry for that. I'm probably mispronouncing some of those. But,
and by the way, that young actress, I think, gives the best performance in the whole movie.
I agree.
Yeah. There's something so vulnerable and authentic about her. And she, her character has vitiligo, which is the pigment disorder that leaves splotches on the skin. It's actually what Michael Jackson had. And this actress has that in real life. And so we get into this kind of muddy situation where they're kind of doing the right thing because they are casting it authentically, but they're not going all the way. I don't think that that completely takes away from the performance of Anna, but like I said, it does present a problem in terms of what you're watching, because you get this feeling like, is the filmmaker making fun of her? And I don't think that's ultimately the case, but the fact is that if you have to ask that question, then that's a problem. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely it does. And yeah, so I was definitely curious to hear your thoughts on that. And you know, as I suspected, it's complicated. I think it is a complicated case because of the Aisha character and that situation too. And I should say at this point, probably that where I'm coming from to this is I'm a parent of two kids with disabilities, one of whom is nonverbal. And as I was watching this movie at the beginning, thinking, oh, she reminds me a little bit of my daughter in some ways. It's different. My daughter Rosie uses a wheelchair as well, and is not autistic. It's not on the spectrum that we know of at this point. But just the fact of thinking about someone teaching a child to act like my daughter, that is inherently kind of offensive to me. And I was like, okay, I don't like that about it. But then the story itself, and this is where we get into some mild spoilers. We don't have to talk about the ending, but some of the arc with Anna's character. So we learned that she did have the ability to speak, had communication ability earlier in life, and at a certain point lost that. And that's what he mentions in the interview that I played the clip from. That's a real situation he'd heard about. And but over the course of the film, through the connection with Aisha, and again, it gets very supernatural, she actually regains the ability to speak sort of temporarily. And it's vague enough that, so what he said in the interview too is that he didn't want to take too many liberties with the situation because there are real people that have kids like this and are that live like this. And ultimately, I think that maybe he did take too many liberties is kind of how I feel about it. Just the idea that some magical force, unnamed magical force, could come and, you know, quote unquote, cure that situation. And then over the course of the film, as things happen that I won't spoil, she then becomes nonverbal again. And so like jumping in and out of that felt disrespectful to me in a way that we're going to invent a supernatural force that can fix this problem, and then it's going to go away again, because again, this is real people deal with this. So like there are scenes where she first is speaking again only around the kids, and then later in front of the parents, and actually Ida tells her mom, and her mom's like, why are you lying, this is so cruel, and is so angry. But then later hears Anna speaking and of course is overjoyed, and so there's a weird recognition there where like, if my daughter suddenly started speaking, of course I would be overjoyed as well. And so it gets into those real things, which I guess in a way is to the film's credit that it like that felt authentic, but at the same time, for the sake of this kind of supernatural fantastical story, just felt like maybe that's a subject matter we shouldn't touch. So yeah, and it is complicated. And I also don't fault anyone who watches this and doesn't think of it, but go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say about your reaction as a parent and how that's dealt with is that I wish, and again, it's like you don't want to review or talk about the movie that they didn't make. Like you have to deal with what they did make. But the thing is that I wish that Vogt and that mother were presented in a way that it was critical of the fact that she was so relieved that her daughter was quote unquote fixed. Right. but the movie never takes that to task. Volk never interrogates that within himself, because he says it's a nightmare, and that may very well be true. I am not a parent, so I cannot speak to that angle. But I know that whatever my parents went through, that they ultimately said, but he's ours, and we love him, and we're going to encourage him and to do what he can do ultimately, which is, you know, 30, 40 odd years down the line. I mean, I have 2 master's degrees at this point. So there is a way of dealing with how parents deal with children who have mm-hmm. disabilities that this movie had a great opportunity to deal with and then just doesn't. And yeah. in terms of the speaking, I think what, and again, I put my sort of like, how would the producers who typically screw this kind of story up be thinking? And they would probably say, well, if she makes that change from nonverbal to verbal and can talk, we need to have somebody who has the capacity to speak in the first place in order to facilitate that change. However, they call it a spectrum for a reason, and you could probably still have gotten someone who lives with autism, who understood that experience, who could speak and could act well enough the silence, and then turn into the character.
Yeah,
down the line where she's talking.
That's a very good point, and I hadn't thought of that.
But the other thing that I wanted to say is that the reason that I love the performance of Aisha so much is because there's something very pure and good and accepting about her. And one of the things about the language that I liked was, and I think Vogt talks about this in the interview, that he was interested in like the secret world of children. And I liked the idea that maybe she could talk, but could only talk to Aisha. And there was something that would have been really poignant about that, the fact that these supposedly outcast, broken children could communicate in ways that the outside world had no idea about. And again, it's like it was right there and they just didn't exploit it in the way that I think would have made a more productive and progressive and fruitful experience, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. And I really like all that. And I want to be clear too, that I didn't watch this and just like angrily fume about it. It just made me pause and think. And as I really wasn't until I really stopped and like, okay, what exactly issues do I feel like I have with this that I was even able to put words to it. And again, like you, and generally kind of like this movie. I just, that aspect of it I struggle with, but I think to what you're saying about, yeah, the opportunity that parents, they could have had to depict parenthood of, you know, being more accepting, I guess, in a way, because yeah, the way that she's so overjoyed when her daughter's speaking again, and it's different than my experience. Again, it's not a one-to-one, but and really, like, where I really took more issue was when I spoke with Vogt and what he said about you know, that's a horror movie to him. It's like, that's, you know, that's not that different from my life that you're describing as a horror movie. And the idea of like being trapped in your body, I think, I've never wanted to cast that sort of a light on my children. Certainly, of course, and just celebrate, you know, whatever they can do. And I think just that difference, it seems like maybe with a little more research or something, you could have come to a conclusion like what, and done something a bit more like what you're saying to have a more nuanced look at it in the film.
Yeah. And again, what you were saying about it being a horror movie in his able-bodied mind, it goes back to that binary, which people like myself or people like Anna are not asking for. You know, it's like, take us as we come.
Yeah.
Both the good and the bad, because it's not a perfect situation. Mm-hmm. It can be messy. So I don't want to have, you know, some kind of circle where peace circle, we're all singing Kumbaya and things are going to be fine. Cause I don't think that that's necessarily the case, but the problem is that it's a disability story, which is great. That's filtered through the experience of someone on the outside of that. And I just think that somebody else could have done a better job. And that is, I'm saying this knowing that this man co-wrote The Worst Person in the World, which is one of the greatest movies of this century and probably the last one. So this is not a person who is unfeeling and doesn't know anything about human behavior. He knows a whole hell of a lot. I just wish that he had extended whatever power and nuance and magic and poetry that he gave to the characters in The Worst Person in the World to his own work.
Yeah, that's maybe a good transition to kind of talk about some other things. So yeah, again, like in my review, I bring up the film Music, the Sia film, which was so controversial, and I don't think it's a one-to-one to that, even though it is similar in some ways that we have a nonverbal character being played by a neurotypical actor. And
talk about a horror movie, though.
I haven't actually seen it myself, but just have read a lot of the discourse around it. But
it's rough. It's rough.
Maybe that would be a good place to start. So can you draw comparisons or how would you say that does compare specifically having seen it to The Innocents? And if the depiction is less well done, maybe can you say why you think?
Because that is? And again, Sia, I love you. I love your music. I love what you do, but this we got to talk about this.
Same.
It seems that she did little to no research, and I think she wanted to be empathetic in trying to get inside this character's head, because the whole thing is that, yes, she's a non-verbal person on the spectrum, this sister of the Kate Hudson character. But she comes alive in these music videos that are basically planted throughout the movie that have all of Sia's songs in them. And those are so spectacular in many ways that it really underlines how shoddy the disability angle and how disconnected the narrative is from its own purpose. I mean, to the extent that there's a lot of quick cutting and strobe effects, which is inherent to music videos, but would be problematic for a lot of people on the spectrum. That's kind of it's a thing. Mm-hmm. And so you didn't even make the movie about a person on the spectrum for that very community. And there was something tone deaf all the way along. And she tried to defend it in the media because people were swift and brutal with their reactions. I mean, apart from the fact that it's just not a very good movie, they wouldn't let this go. And I don't know. It's the type of thing that's such a misfire that you hope that this is a teachable moment, and that she may return to something like this and do it right.
That is something that I would like to watch that movie, you know, for academic purposes at some point. I haven't watched it yet, but that's interesting to hear about that. I'm curious, when you think about a film that does it really well, as far as like representing a disabled person, is there a film that jumps to mind or one or two you want to talk about?
Oh, sure. One of the king daddies for me is a movie called The Tribe, Ukrainian film from 2014. Have you seen this?
I'm aware of it, but I haven't seen it, but I know a bit about it.
So basically, it takes place in a Ukrainian boarding school for the deaf. And it involves the students getting into all sorts of criminal behavior. And the movie is cast authentically. And the most baller thing about it is that the director, Miroslav Shabovitsky, I think is his name. I apologize for butchering that. He has the entire 2.5 hours with no subtitles. So you're forced to really lean in and pay attention to the sign language that's going on. But the movie's so brilliantly directed that you never really lose sight of that. And it invites you, the audience, into the experience of not being able to necessarily communicate verbally. And how do you navigate a world that's full of danger and sound that you can't hear? And so it ends up being very, very suspenseful in that regard. So I highly recommend that. That's on Netflix, I believe. It's 2.5 hours, and it's not an easy sit. But if you really want to learn something about where disability narrative can go and should go, at least in the direction, then I would point you to that, certainly.
That's really interesting. So there's no subtitles for that. Is there a soundtrack? Like, as the audience, are you hearing the world around them, or is it silent?
Yes. Yeah. That's the other thing, is so you are often tipped off to things that are happening in the world that sort of increase the suspense, because the characters don't realize how treacherous the situation is.
That is interesting. And so that's interesting. Like a counterpoint to something like last year's Coda, a film which I liked fine, I didn't love, but that's interesting that in that film we have a lot of deaf characters, but also the main character is hearing, and it's kind of about the way that affects her life and her family and all of that. And that's interesting, but it sounds like this would really be more immersive to put you almost in the headspace and kind of the experience of these characters. That's pretty cool.
And it goes to this idea of perspective. And I think we've talked about this, and certainly in the past and on Filmosophy, is that the reason that The Tribe works is because it puts you completely in the perspective of those characters as a hearing audience, and demands that you contend with that. The problem with something like Coda, and again, I feel the same way. It's like it's fine, and I like some moments about it. And Troy Kotsur he's good, and they cast it authentically. So it's a step in the right direction. But the problem with that movie, and this a little spoiler for Coda, is that the whole sort of melodramatic, sort of emotional whoosh of the movie in the end with the hearing daughter singing is that it's predicated on you being able to hear it. So it leaves out the very audience that it was about and for. And so it was like, it's one of those like, nice try guys, but do better.
Yeah, that's interesting too. And I'm thinking of another movie that's similar in some ways again, and that is the movie Sound of Metal from a couple of years ago. And that one is different in that, we have a hearing character who goes through and he loses his hearing and then ends up joining a deaf community, and feels very empathetic for that reason, because it is cast authentically for everyone except for the lead, who, is going through this challenge. But I really love where that movie ends up as far as the empathy that it brings. And it ends up there's a lot about cochlear implants in the movie, it's a whole controversial thing, I think. And the movie does kind of take a side in a way about that. I really love that movie, and it feels, more empathetic perhaps than something like Coda. But, have you seen that movie? Do you have any thoughts on that one?
Yes. I, actually hate that movie pretty much.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, sorry. But I will agree about the ending. I think that the final moments are the most powerful and moving thing in the entire story. Because I like the idea of acceptance. I just didn't buy a lot of what he goes through over the course of the movie enough to get fully on board. I mean, it's one of those things, and this I'm really speaking about the girlfriend character, is that it's one of these movies where you know that a person's gotten their life together because they got their hair cut. I just know.
Well, fair enough. But yeah, that's interesting.
But again, noble effort. Yeah. Noble effort.
Yeah. Yeah. Was there another film you're going to bring up that you think is a especially good representation?
Well, okay. So here's where we get into the controversial part about able-bodied playing disabled. Mm-hmm. There was a movie that came out 30 years ago, actually, called The Water Dance, which is another movie that I recommend everybody seek out. And it stars Eric Stoltz and Wesley Snipes in what I think is his best performance, William Forsythe and Helen Hunt. And it involves the Eric Stoltz character getting into an accident that turns him into a quadriplegic. And he's having a relationship, an affair with the Helen Hunt character. So he has to deal with that and how life changes from there. But he also is getting used to the fact that he's now in this rehab hospital and has to get better. And he's meeting the other residents. Now, the three leads, so we're saying Eric Stoltz, Wesley Snipes, and William Forsythe, all three of them can walk. But the director of the movie, whose name is Neil Jimenez, who was paralyzed in an accident, brings so much authenticity to the way that it's directed, the way that it's written, the subjects that it brings up about accessibility, about relationships and sexuality. I mean, it deals very frankly with that in particular. That yes, it should have been cast differently. And 30 years on, if it were remade, you would want to insist on something like that. But again, I think they get so empathetically close to that experience that when I saw that, and I was a kid, it completely changed my life, because I thought, this finally, there's another movie that's speaking directly to me about the things that give me sorrow, that give me joy, that give me courage. And I'm just so grateful that Neil Jimenez exists and that he did this. And funny little side story, when I was in college at NYU, I used to spend time at the Tower Video, which is Tower Records. I don't know if you remember Tower Records, or too young for that audience. But Tower Records was a big deal in the 90s, particularly in New York, and they had a separate video store. And there was one day after class that I was in that video store just looking at all the movies, and Wesley Snipes came in. Well, and I really did not know how to react, but I just ran up and down the aisles trying to find The Water Dance on a copy of it. And he was with people, so you couldn't really get close to him because he was just looking at movies, but he was just trying to be a normal person, I suppose. But I went to one end of the aisle that where he was at, and I just held it up. And he looked over, and I just said, thank you. And And he nodded and he winked. And that was the extent of it. But you know what? It was a moment where I get, you know, thank you for doing this. You know, thank you for changing me and putting this out into the world. So that was it was a good moment.
Yeah, wow. What an incredible
story. Didn't mean to get sidetracked.
No, that's great. I feel like I've heard a lot of little interesting interactions that you've had with filmmakers and people over the years. You're just full of great stories. Yeah. I love it. Well, cool. Let's see. Did you have any other films, either positive or negative, that you wanted to bring into the discussion?
Yes. So talking about being on the spectrum and nonverbal, have you seen the documentary Life Animated?
No, I've not. I've heard of it. I haven't seen it.
Okay, you need to run and see this immediately. It rests at the number one spot for the decade, maybe even the century so far, but the decade certainly, with The Act of Killing as the best movie that I've seen since I've lived in LA. And what it's a documentary about a family who have a son who is, like I said, nonverbal on the spectrum, who is in one of these scenarios that Iskovolt talks about, where the boy seemed like he was okay, quote unquote, and then he just lost the speech and sort of went into himself. But then they started showing him, as a kid, Disney movies. And slowly but surely, without any doctors or therapists, the movies are what brought this kid out of that silence and got him talking again. And he would relate to the movies, and he learned a number of valuable lessons from that. And from that in sort of encouragement of the movie going, this guy was able to grow up, start live on his own, become an advocate. And I cannot tell you, and I saw it at LA Film Fest. I had to go all the way to Culver City, which doesn't mean anything to you, but it's not close to where I live. But I did it. And I it was one of the few movies where I just sat there in my seat after it was done, just completely stunned. Because again, it was like, oh, so the movies, they do liberate us in many ways. And it wasn't about making excuses for this guy's behavior or his condition. It was a celebration of life and inclusivity. And I to this day, I'm bowled over by it. And in fact, when there's a part in the movie where the young man shows the movie Aladdin to a number of people in a home, in a group home, and they're all losing their minds. And then he brings in the actor who voiced Jafar, and then he gets Gilbert Gottfried to come in. And I remember thinking, I went right back to that moment when I heard that Gilbert Gottfried had died, and how well he connected with everybody in that moment, and how it became a celebration of art. It became a celebration of life and what is possible. And it's something that maybe some people might find mawkish or cute or whatever, but I was in absolute awe of it. And because it hit so close to my own experience in many ways and my sort of love affair with movies, I'm going to carry that one for the rest of my days.
Wow. Yeah.
I need to take a sip of liquid death to swallow my feelings.
I've had it. That's a film I've heard of, but I have not seen. And I actually did not know that's what it was about. That's absolutely going to be watched soon here. Very interesting. As we've talked about a handful of different films, it seems, I'm trying to see if are there any kind of general principles we can pull out from things. And, you know, whenever possible, having disabled actors play disabled characters seems like a pretty easy guideline to pull. And it just sounds like, it seems like it always has to be on a case-by-case basis. And there's not necessarily a one-size-fits-all answer to anything. But generally, empathy sounds like something that... Does that sound accurate? Like, just imbuing as much empathy and real care for real people as possible when depicting something like this.
But what I think is tied to that explicitly, and this goes for every single filmmaker on the face of the earth, you are not exempt from this, is you do your homework. Mm-hmm. Don't just write something off the top of your head and think that it's going to fly, particularly if it is not your experience. Mm-hmm. Do the research, talk to as many people as you can, because the empathy that we're talking about is bred out of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a place called Hollywood Health and Society. It's an organization that's tied to the Norman Lear Foundation out here in LA. And their entire purpose for being is creating a research center for creative people to look up health and medical issues and how they relate to our everyday lives. So there's really no excuse for you not doing that homework. So I would encourage everybody to Google them and to look them up. They're called Hollywood Health and Society. But that will put anybody who has questions about this on the right path. And I think we need to encourage people within the disability community to use their voices more. It's getting much, much better. But when I was in film school at NYU, which I graduated with highest honor, so it's not like I didn't show up, but I felt alienated the whole time because people saw me as this guy that, with the spina bifida, who, what can he do? And because there was this collaborative art form that we were all dealing with, the work suffered as a result. And mm-hmm. I ended up locking myself in an editing room and being angry and lost a lot of the time. So you have to find where your tribe is. I mean, to just say exactly that, it's to find where they are and make sure that your voice is heard. Which I know is easier said than done, but again, I think this, certainly this younger generation, as if I'm so old, is getting better about not taking shit lying down, which good for them. Education and be truthful to your own experience, but make sure that you're tied into everyone else's as best you can, cast authentically. Oh, and another important one, because I come from a writing background chiefly, is that you really have to interrogate cliches and why we use them, why we are so dependent on them, and how do we sort of write outside the box and create more authentic stories that way. Because, and I go back to the whole thing about my not struggling, but my sort of ambivalence about the able-bodied people playing these characters, is that I do think that a movie like The Water Dance does tell the truth despite not being cast authentically. Another example mm-hmm. would be, have you seen Scott Frank's The Lookout?
I have not.
So Joseph Gordon-Levitt plays a kid who suffers a traumatic brain injury that affects his memory. And then he gets involved with a number of criminals. And I won't say any more than that, except that it is an extraordinary, towering work of art. And it does the thing that I love most about movies, which is it takes genre, which in this case is a crime film, and mixes it with enough kind of real life. So I've had a traumatic brain injury as well as a congenital one. So I could identify with the Joseph Gordon-Levitt character in that respect. But it gives so much power to this guy without ever selling out the trouble that he has. So it's this brilliant balancing act that Scott Frank does in the end. And so I guess my point is that don't confine your stories, if you're going to tell them about disability, to things like hospitals or mm-hmm. the sad kid sitting by himself at lunch. There is that. I'm not denying it, but it's much more interesting to me to see people with disabilities or characters with disabilities just doing stuff and taking care of themselves. I mean, I did another podcast recently called My Favorite Shitty Movie, in which we talked about Mac and Me. Do you know about that movie?
Yes. And I listened to some of that actually in prep for this, but I didn't finish it.
Yeah. So there's a moment in that where the hero, who's a kid in a wheelchair, who actually has spina bifida in real life, it was cast authentically despite the mm-hmm. shortcomings of that movie. They did that right. And he's racing along a car, and the people in the car manage to scoop him up with the wheelchair into the car, and they race away from the bad guys. And they don't make a thing out of it. Hmm. It's like they include this kid in this action sequence, and that was the end of it. And I thought, that was for as crappy as this movie is at times, that was pretty badass that the director thought to do that. And so I just wouldn't limit yourself to what you think the limitations of disability are. Just treat it as another life experience like everybody has.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is any of this making sense?
Yes, absolutely. And I appreciate all of that. I think that it's this. I mean, I'm going to listen back to this podcast again after. It's funny when I record something in the moment, I'm like trying to soak it all in, but I almost always go back and listen just to hear my guests and what they said again to kind of soak this in more. But yeah, I think that is definitely helping to shape how I feel about different things and how I'm going to think about it going forward. But yeah, I think that all makes a ton of sense. And I thank you so much for coming in and sharing today. Well, one other interesting part of this whole conversation is that some people do sometimes compare this to the idea of blackface or having white actors play non-white characters, which is somewhat related to also, I've seen a similar discussion around gay and straight characters. How do you think that conversation relates to disability?
It pisses me off, to put it bluntly. And that's because I think this kind of rose up prominently when Blair Underwood, who is an African-American actor, was cast in the redo of Ironside. And again, for you youngins out there, Ironside was a show from the 70s about a cop in a wheelchair. And Blair Underwood was cast in this thing, and people immediately started getting upset in a, to start for the right reason, because they wanted it authentically cast, which we've talked about this up and down. But what kept creeping into the conversation was comparing what an actor like Blair Underwood would be doing to blackface. And my infuriated response was, you know, there's so much garbage heaped on the disability community as it is to ostracize us. We don't need ignorance on top of that. Because the fact is that blackface was a 19th century practice by white people that was engineered specifically to devalue and demean the black experience in America. It was its whole purpose. So I don't ever think that an actor with the integrity that someone like Blair Underwood would have would ever be talking down to that character. And you sure as hell cannot say that about Daniel Day-Lewis in My Left Foot. You cannot say that about any of the actors in The Water Dance. You cannot say that about John Hawkes in The Sessions, which was written and directed by my friend Ben Lewin, who's a magnificent human being, who has had a disability experience because he has post-polio syndrome. So that piece of that movie was authentic. It really, really bothered me. And I'm glad that we've kind of backed away from that over time, but it still comes up every once in a while. And I'm just like, come on, we've got other things to worry about. But what made me think when that happened about blackface, so I started thinking about something like the Harlem Renaissance and what I think is necessary in the end for this ship to go completely in the right direction for the rest of time is the people within the disability community need to create their own independent film movement. Stories about us, for us, and most importantly, by us. And we can show them that our stories are worth telling and are a force to be reckoned with. And the fact is, 25% of the population in this country of America has a disability of some kind. That's a statistical fact. So these studios and networks are sitting on a gold mine with getting that many more people involved in watching whatever they're producing. So I can appeal to the baser side of Hollywood and say, ladies and gentlemen, you could be making a lot more money if you just paid a little more attention to this. But more importantly, it's that my wish is that more artists would speak for themselves and make things for themselves. Don't rely on the people, you know, on the other side of the gilded, you know, fence or gate. Mm-hmm. We're on the right side of things. Mm-hmm. We're on the right side of things. And so I think I would close with that.
I love that. Yeah, it's so interesting because there is such a push for inclusion in so many different ways. But when you see those things so often, disability is still left out of it, which is so interesting and frustrating and kind of baffling. But yeah, I love that. And let's hope that happens. And what would you say to someone who, you know, how can anyone support this? Or is there anything that, you know, layperson not involved in the film community could put dollars to or support in some way to kind of, are there charities or causes that you know that?
Well, I don't know about anything specifically, but I'll say this. I'm no longer associated with real abilities at this point, but they're in their fifth year. So that tells me that this is a vital thing to have. And what they've been doing for the past few years is they've been doing it completely streaming. So anybody in the country can tune in. And I would always encourage to do that, because you're going to hear conversations with filmmakers about these types of stories that need to be told and need to be told more frequently. And so they're a great organization for that alone. And plus they showed some pretty kick-ass movies when I was working there, because I helped program the thing, so I know. But like I got to have a conversation with Caroline Thompson, who wrote Edward Scissorhands.
Oh yes, I've seen that. Yeah,
one of the greatest moments of my life. And I can't believe I went this entire conversation and I didn't mention Edward Scissorhands.
I almost brought it up, but I didn't know if you wanted to go there with it.
Well, okay. So we'll say this. I know that you want to talk to me about this movie at some point. So we'll continue to leave them thirsty. Yes. And we'll put it off for another full episode. So you'll get the Edward Scissorhands conversation eventually, people, but not quite today.
I like that. I think that's a good way to leave it. And so what Michael's kind of referencing is I've thought this could be a fertile ground for a whole series of films, you know, like I do different series of different kinds on the show, and having some sort of a, you know, disability on film, looking at 4, 5, 6 movies. And I think that would be a great one to do, because I know you have so many thoughts about it.
Let me be your programmer.
Absolutely. That's my main goal with the podcast, is to like people who are passionate about whatever and kind of get out of the way for that. So yes, you can pick all the movies, you can do most of the talking. I love it.
Okay, so basically you're just offloading work.
Yes, and now I don't have to do anything. Exactly. No. Okay. I mean, if you listen to any of my conversations with Rance Collins, that's kind of what it is. It's like, oh, I watched the movie, here's what I thought about it. But he's like, here's my encyclopedia of classic film knowledge that I know. And he just dumps it out, and it's great.
Anyway. Was that the guy I listened to the Nightmare Alley episode? Yes. Was that who you did that with?
Yeah, okay. Nightmare Alley. Yeah. We're doing film noir right now. I was going to say something about that at the end, just to check that out. We're actually going to do Chinatown neo-noir in the next one. We just did In a Lonely Place.
The great, great one.
Yes. So I'm excited to revisit that one too. Anyway, I think that's a good enough place to wrap things up. Thank you so much, Michael, for your time and your thoughts. And I'm so excited for people to hear this. And really, yes, we should do more, I think, in this vein.
And if anybody wants to find me outside of this sphere, you can do that on Facebook, and I'll continue to have the conversation, because I think that it's important. Yes. And I know you're hip to it, but you're not the rest of the world. So, and I think the more we encourage this, the better.
Yeah. Hopefully this can, I mean, this is something that I feel like I'm still learning so much about, and not so long ago knew nothing, you know, to even have a conversation like this. So hopefully this is, you know, helping other people learn and grow as well. I'll definitely link also to your social media things and to the Real Abilities Festival. I think that's a great way to just support artists. And I think niche festivals in general are great for that sort of thing. And it's great that it's virtual and can do it from anywhere. So I will link to that stuff.
And one last thing that I just thought of. I don't know if you have like college age or high school age kids, young people that are listening. Maybe you do.
Some, I think.
But if you're thinking about film school, or you're in film school, my first cynical, snobby response would be like, just don't go, because it's awful. But I won't say that. What I will say is that if you're going into one of those situations, make sure that you find the mentors that you need, but also if they have a disability organization within the school, make sure you get keyed into that and make no apologies for it. Because if you need support, which we all do, you deserve that. And I want to see I want to see people have an experience that I didn't have, which was good and healthy, and where you get to do things that are creative and wonderful, and get that. So I want to encourage people to speak up.
That's great. And yeah, next generation of artists, you know, are the ones that with the real power in this situation. So I think that's a great note to end on as well. Thank you again so much, Michael, for being here. Really love the discussion. And that will kind of wrap this episode up. If you're listening, also, I encourage you to read the review I wrote of The Innocents. And also, you can watch the full video. Again, it's like a 5-6 minutes interview I did with the director, which I will link to in the show notes. Stay tuned to the podcast for the next couple of episodes. As I was just saying, Chinatown, we're going to continue our film noir series looking at Chinatown. And then one other thing that's new on the website is I also reviewed just a new review of the new film Happening, which is a French film about unwanted pregnancy that is very good. It won the Golden Lion last year. And so I'll recommend that. And you can check out my review at arthousegarage.com. And with that, thank you so much for listening to Arthouse Garage. We have a few years worth of episodes now. You can hear those all in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. You can learn more at appallingproductions.com. If you want to support Arthouse Garage, become a patron over at patreon.com/arthousegarage or find a link in the show notes. You can also buy an Arthouse Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. If you want to support us without spending any money, you can leave a rating or review in your podcast app, and that is hugely helpful. You can also stay in the loop about the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter at arthousegarage.com/subscribe. And you can also email me directly anytime, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search at Arthouse Garage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening. And until next time, keep it snob free.